Okay, great. So I'm Rick Hansen. This is June 11th, 2014. And as you probably know, I've been in Europe, came back very briefly because my wife had a problem with her foot, which is getting better. Then I went out again, then I came back. And I was joking that jet lag is like good drugs. You know, you sort of relax and it feels like it's 3 a.m. all the time, but it's really okay. And, you know, so anyway, no brain, no pain, as they say. So if I start to lose a little bit or concentration, just kind of wave your hands or something. Anyway, I want to talk about the intersection of two great themes in psychology and their connection to Dharma practice. The two great themes are autonomy and intimacy. And it's fairly straightforward to be autonomous, which is to say independent and self-determined, self-directed, etc. It's also fairly straightforward to be intimate, to be connected, to be caring, to be joined, to have feeling for others, such as taking joy in their own welfare. But the combination of the two, the intersection of being on your own side while simultaneously resting in a lovingness for other people and an openness to other people, that's not so easy, and it could be a long-term kind of practice. These two are often talked about as if it's either or. You know, how can I be me while I'm connected to you? If I'm connected to you, will I have to give up myself, right? But in fact, it takes autonomy to sustain intimacy. In the classic proverb, fences make for good neighbors, right? It's because it's when you are clear in your bones that you can take care of your own needs that you're most prepared to open out into the deep waters of intimacy. Flipped on the other side, both developmentally in early childhood and throughout childhood and then also in adulthood, through resting in wholesome, healthy relationships and through internalizing repeatedly the experience of being cared for and liked and included and cherished and prized and loved, that feeds autonomy inside us, that helps us carry with ourselves from the inside out the felt sense of others who are on our own side. As you may know, there's a saying in Alcoholics Anonymous, the mind is a dangerous neighborhood. Never go in alone. Right? In other words, there's a place for internalizing the felt sense of others who care about us. That helps us be more autonomous. Okay. In Buddhism, a kind of analog to these two great themes is equanimity and compassion. Equanimity is a very, very important notion in psychology and also in Buddhism. It's sometimes described as walking evenly over uneven ground. A teacher of mine spoke of a minister in LA who used the expression, looking at the world with quiet eyes. It's another way of talking about equanimity. Shantideva, the great Tibetan Buddhist teacher, pointed out that the world is covered with sharp stones and brambles and thorns and other people. And he said we could cover the world with leather or we could put on a pair of shoes. There, too, a kind of equanimity. In neuropsychological terms, moment to moment is a very efficient way to help us understand and help animals respond to the world. There's a sense of experiences as pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, or perhaps arguably emerging more and more in us, the most social species of animal on the planet, a sense as well of experiences being heartfelt. So it's natural when something's unpleasant to treat it as a signal to avoid harm. If something's pleasant, to treat it as a signal to approach rewards. If something's neutral, you know, to treat it as a signal to keep looking for something that would be satisfying. Also, if something is heartfelt, it's understandable and natural to treat it as a signal that there's an opportunity to attach to others, to meet our needs for connection. So far, so good. But as the Buddha pointed out, if we get reactive to what's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, or let's say heartfelt, if we get reactive to it, we get disturbed. You know, The ground of life is constantly changing, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, and heartfelt. Can we walk evenly over that ground? Can we install a kind of inner shock absorber so that as our experiences are unpleasant, we don't need to go to war with them? We can respond appropriately. We can deal with challenges, but we don't need to get our knickers in a twist about it. Similarly, with things that are pleasant or neutral or even heartfelt, can we establish our equanimity? Also, compassion. Can we wish that beings not suffer? And usually have, along with that wish, that intention, that stance, that goodwill, along with that, can we have warm-hearted concern? Okay, so far, kind of define the terms. Where it gets interesting is in relationships where the sweet spot, I think of it as sort of like, I called it the other day, the gold zone, where we both have compassion for the other person and we are living in a stance of goodwill toward them. They may not be our best friend. We don't have to approve of them. We don't have to like them. We might want to get away from them. But we have some fundamental quality of benevolence, goodwill. That's what benevolence means, bene vole, goodwill, as opposed to ill will toward that person. Can we do that? Can we do that? Can you do that in an important relationship? So it might help, if you are not already doing it by now, to think of a difficult, challenging relationship. It could be a very wonderful, beautiful relationship, but there's something about it that's challenging for you. That will help make this more real. So I want to talk a bit about it and then kind of open it up for discussion and situations, if you care to talk about that. Okay. So can we, with this person, have goodwill for them while simultaneously having a kind of equanimity about how they're treating us while taking care of ourselves, and also not feeling overly responsible for their pain? How to actually do that? You can kind of see that this is important territory, the intersection of the two. It's no mean feat. So, for example, children. My wife and I have two kids, they're young adults now. One of the hardest things as a parent is to realize that, number one, you can't prevent your child's suffering. And number two, it's actually up to them to deal with it. And then if you jump into it yourself, you obstruct their own learning, their own growth. How to hold that? Or how to be in a situation where someone is blaming you for their own pain. Maybe they want to be with you in ways that you don't want to be with them. Ways large or small. They want a promotion and you don't think they're ready. They want to be your lover and or keep being your lover and it's just not happening for you in that department with them. Or maybe they want to spend more time with you and in your life you just have this much time for the relationship. You don't have this much time. Whatever it might be. So there's a kind of maybe a grievance coming at you or a want coming at you. How can you remain peaceful about that, including feeling, in a healthy sense, entitled to not satisfy their want? Or maybe they've got a grievance coming at you, and in your own heart, you don't really feel guilt or remorse. You don't feel like you did anything wrong. Maybe they had a preference for chocolate and you served them vanilla, right? And that's about the extent of it. You regret that they're suffering. You wish that they weren't suffering. Regret is distinct from guilt, shame, and remorse. But you don't feel like it's your fault that they're suffering. Except they want you to feel like it's your fault. You ever had that kind of interaction? Yeah? See what I mean? How do we navigate this territory? So I want to offer three suggestions and then open it up for discussion. All right? Number one suggestion is to really let yourself feel the connection and the intimacy and the suffering of the other person. I think a lot of us actually don't have any kind of innate issue with being caring or loving or open or receptive to other people. It's just that along the way, it felt overwhelming or uncomfortable, or we couldn't tolerate the sense of closeness with that other with other people. So the first suggestion is to explore for yourself, am I resisting the feeling of connection here or the feeling of intimacy with this other person because it kind of floods me? It's a little bit like, you know, getting your pupils dilated at the eye doctor. All this light starts coming in and it's like, oh wow, too much. I need my sunglasses. Can you expand your tolerance for receiving other people, for feeling their pain? And work to expand the heart, you know, to open the heart, to tolerate like the realness of being with another person, seeing the being behind the eyes, really feeling like, wow, what it's like to be them. It's wonderful in some ways and it's difficult in others. Can you tolerate that experience? I think that a lot of what creates difficulty in relationship is we don't actually receive the other person. So what do people do when they knock on the door and no one answers? Some people walk away. A lot of people start knocking more and more loudly. Right? Flip it around. What's one of the most beautiful, powerful, important experiences we have? It's to feel genuinely received by other people. Like they stay open to us in their eyes, they let us in. They don't have to agree with us. They don't have to be our best friend, but they let us in, right? Isn't that a great experience to have? It's kind of astonishing. And it's, as I think I said this maybe the last time I was here, it's one of the easiest and biggest gifts we can offer to other people to actually receive them and let them have the experience of being received. As Dan Siegel describes it, feeling felt. Giving them the gift of feeling felt by you. That's an exploration right there. For me, you know, in my own life and personal journey, really focusing on the dimension of love and opening the heart has been extremely important for me. You know, I had willfulness pretty much going for me. You know, I had understanding, discernment pretty much going for me. But that opening of the heart, wow, what an ongoing practice to really engage. Okay. Second suggestion is to have a kind of felt recognition, which often starts more conceptually, and that's fine. That's the beginning. It starts there, but it shouldn't end there as being merely conceptual. The felt recognition of differentiation, or to put it a different kind of way, that the causes streaming through you to make this moment of consciousness are distinct from the causes streaming through that other person to make this moment of consciousness. In other words, they have their karmas, you have your karmas. And I think this is one of the interesting paradoxes in the Dharma, that there's both an emphasis on interdependence. We're intertwined with each other, which is also the inside of modern physics, ecology, postmodernist analysis. You know, we're intertwined with each other. And yet at the same time, there's this fundamental differentiation. Your thoughts are your thoughts. My thoughts are my thoughts. You know, I'm not implicated in your mind stream, that language. You know, the mind stream over there is the mind stream over there. The mind stream over here is the mind stream over here. There's differentiation. Because there's differentiation, I can tolerate intimacy with you. Research on empathy shows that people who have very porous boundaries, blurred boundaries, have a hard time sustaining empathy for other people, because they get flooded. And this is also, equanimity is very much about insight in the deeper levels of it. It's this insight around impermanence and just things streaming along, and just the recognition that over there, of the pie chart of causes that's making your child suffer, or your friend, right? Or the pie chart of causes that's leading them to have a grievance with you. Of that pie chart of causes, the slice that has to actually do with you, causes originating in you, is usually a very small fraction of that pie, and often there's no slice at all. You actually have nothing to do with this moment for this other person. If you think about it, of what's causing it, their history, their biology, their temperament, their parents, their parents' parents, their parents' parents' parents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? The first thing I said about opening our heart helps us be equanimous without being numb or cold or dismissive, producing avoidantly attached children or whatever, other people as well. There's a warm-heartedness, but also the insight, the wisdom that recognizes, your streaming is over there, my streaming is over here. And then the last suggestion is, it's a funny one, it's to look at situations from a more impersonal perspective in terms of what would be appropriate here, or what's reasonable, what's fair, in a more disinterested, impersonal kind of way. Here I am with you. I'm looking at the situation maybe in a bird's eye view. You have a grievance with me, right? Let's say that, I didn't invite you to something. Or let's say that, I dropped the ball in some way. Okay? From a more impersonal kind of bird's eye view perspective, what's the truth? All right, I screwed up in these ways. Looking at it from a bird's eye view, I don't think there was a moral fault. I wasn't mean, I wasn't evil, as I decide for myself what's moral or immoral. But I did drop the ball. I could put some correction in. So you're right, I'm gonna cop to that as fast as I can, partly because that's the quickest way to get you off my back, right? And it's also the most moral thing to do. And I'm going to implement, correction for the future, and I'm sincerely committed to it. I know I may not be perfect about it, but I know I'm sincerely committed to it. And I don't have to prove it to you. I'm just watch to see what I do. I'm not trying to convince you, but I am putting in correction. Or maybe from a bird's eye view, I look at it and I go, I don't think there's a moral fault here. I don't even think there's anything to correct. You just have a different preference, right? Or you had an expectation that I didn't really agree with. Or you thought I had made an agreement that honestly I never made. We really didn't say that to each other, And I regret that you're upset about this, but honestly, I don't feel like I'm a cause in any way. Right? So it's a bird's eye view. Or we might look at a situation and go, these two people here, what's appropriate, what's going to help? In an impersonal kind of way, taking it less personally. So it's this ironic paradox that looking at it impersonally actually assists us in serving the needs of each of the persons involved in the situation. So I just kind of want to lay those out, and then maybe we can talk about particular situations, or maybe, which wouldn't surprise me, there's some way in which I haven't been clear tonight. Just a quick recap. Practicing around opening the heart, having insight into differentiation. The causes streaming through that person are different from the causes streaming through you. And then taking a kind of impersonal bird's eye view about what is true and what is fair and what is skillful as a guiding principle. Okay, so far? What do you think? Questions or comments, please. And including difficult situations.
I could share one of those, but I'll just ask. I'm having a little bit, I'm not clear on the difference between two
Okay. Maybe it would help, I think, if we talked about a situation. So I'll tell a little story about myself. Maybe that's a way to do it.
What was
the question? The question is, what's the difference between 2 and 3? And so, because this involves other people, I'm just going to take a moment to think about this for a second. Well, I'll just say, so I'm going to make it a little fuzzy, but the essence is true. So I was in a situation where someone that I was close to died. And so there were multiple people involved. And the spouse, it was, as it turned out, a man, the spouse of the woman, his wife died. He was pretty rattled and upset, older man. And I was involved with some other people around the situation. And I found myself, you know, kind of stepping in to sort of a guiding, helping, problem-solving kind of mode. You know, your strengths can become your weaknesses fairly quickly if you're not careful about it. And another person involved got irritated with me, and it felt like I was sort of taking over. Okay. So it's your usual messy situation, right? And this other person then really got upset about it, way over the top, way intense. Like, whoa! You know, again, people tend to get pretty turbocharged around certain situations, including losing loved ones. Okay. So what do we do there? So just to walk it through, the first suggestion I made around opening the heart is to try to keep my own heart open, which is really fairly easy to do when everybody's lovey-dovey, but when you're being blamed and there's a lot of heat coming at you, and some of it's true, but a lot of it's like, whoa, you know, to keep your heart open. So that's a practice. I actually had a teacher use the expression, keeping the wound of the heart green, by which he meant open and soft. The wound of the heart. Isn't that lovely? Right? The wound of the heart. In a healthy sense, we keep the wound of the heart. Okay. Second, differentiation. I could see, wow, you know, the stuff moving through me, both in the moment and also in my personal history, that would lead me to kind of move into problem-solving mode and trying to sort things out and clarifying and, you know, initiating and all the rest of that. I could see a lot of that streaming through me. The other person involved in the situation, you know, that person's relationship to the other people involved and to me in the history, I could see also, you know, that's a whole different deal, right? And so it's understandable, quote unquote, that I would do what I did, in a sense, and it's understandable that the other person would have the reactions, it was a woman, that she had. And you could see, like, oh yeah, they're kind of different from each other. My take on the situation was different from her take. My priorities were a little different from her priorities. My hot buttons are different from her hot buttons, you know. You can kind of see that. And then the bird's eye view, right, where you go up here and you go, hey, look, somebody just died. Everybody's upset, right? Everybody's kind of revved up and turbocharged and reactive. And when people get upset and turbocharged, they tend to default to their strong suits, right, of various kinds. That's what people do. Okay, that's happening. All right, what's called for here? Well, so I'm bird's eye view. Was I, you know, in my view, was there a moral fault in what I did, how I considered that? I don't think so. I didn't have evil intention. I wasn't there to, like, exploit the situation in some shameful way for my own thing. I was just kind of revved up to problem solve and help. But I get it. It was unskillful on my part. It was too much. It didn't make room for the other people. And more skillful, I could have understood in retrospect, oh yeah, of course they would have natural reactions in that situation. Right, so far? So, you know, bird's eye view, I could see that part. I could also see, yeah, this person, in my view, is actually really overreacting. But I can see that there's this legitimate core that's turbocharged and top spin and flaming. But that's what people do. That's what, gosh, people, pardon me. That's what I do. Yeah. You know, we. You know, Virginia Satir, the master family therapist, she had this thing she would do in workshops where she would ask people to go around and acknowledge that they all had a belly button. Everybody's human. They'd even bump into each other, you know, their navels, like naval warfare, not really, but they would bump into each other, right? Yeah? So, because we're all human. Okay, so I could see that. That's my view, you know, and I could be wrong, but I'm willing. We can only have our own view, so it's okay to have your own view. You've got to, the question is, do we claim it? Yeah, that is my view. I think there was overreacting, but I'm going to cut that person slack. I get it, of course, no problem. Sorry about that part, you know? I guess that's what I mean, and then I'm going to figure out what's appropriate. So what's appropriate for me is to cop to my part. Yep, sorry about that. Jumped in too fast, didn't leave room for you and other people to have your role and part, and obviously you wanted to contribute too. And when I claim that space, there's no room for you. Oh. Those listening on the recording didn't see my gesture where I thumped myself in the head a few times. That's a learning method. You know, you don't hate yourself too hard, though. Okay, so I guess that's a way of walking through it. And so you see the combination? Like a warm-heartedness and clarity. Maybe that's another way to talk about this. The dimension of warmth and the dimension of clarity. Clarity going to equanimity. Can you think of other situations, perhaps? Yeah, please. Uh-huh.
And she talks about one of my favorite passages is when she talks about how if you've gone through a lot of pain and you think of it like a way to open up your heart is to think of it like a or to open up your ability to face a challenge is like likening a teaspoon of salt and a glass of water.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
But when you start talking about opening your heart, I wonder if you could use that analogy as a way to open your heart more to bring in the good stuff as opposed to, you know, the suffering side of it. And it seemed like that's a good way to make
Yeah. Thank you. I think you said it. I'll just quickly recap. It's a traditional metaphor that Sharon Salzberg used. You know, the idea of pain being like salt and awareness being like water. So you put a spoon of salt in a cup and stir it. Tastes terrible. But take the same amount of pain, put it in a nice big bucket of clean water, stir it around, drink a cup, you hardly taste it. And you're talking there about using that as a way to kind of open the heart, you know, that awareness is like this big space. And in there, as we open our heart, there might be something painful, but we can afford to open our heart because we're not overwhelmed by the pain. Yeah, okay.
I was wondering if someone else can expand on, because I don't know how, like, what situation you would, and how would that feel in your head and your heart to do that?
Yeah, well, think about a particular situation, like a family member who's in pain, right? Where I think that this combination of compassion and equanimity is particularly hard is when someone is complaining about you and you think it's unfair. It's an unfair accusation, right? That's where it gets really interesting. And so for me, you know, maybe we could talk more about those kind of situations where you keep your heart open to them through methods like you're talking about, while at the same time realizing that, you know, I'm not to blame for your pain. And paradoxically, feeling based on insight and clarity, appropriately, not being defensive. That's the thing. I think often we're defensive because we're not equanimous. If we had more established equanimity, shock absorbers, we actually could afford to really open to other people and take responsibility for our part, but not the part that we don't think from this impersonal bird's eye view perspective is really our own. Yeah, please.
Well, I just have one that I'm struggling with. I usually have a decent, it's usually not that hard to keep my heart open. I'm having a challenge with a past professional relationship said something untrue about me.
Yeah.
And to other people in my profession. And thankfully, somebody on the email chain knows me and sent it to me. So I now have evidence, and I also have a contract to say that we wouldn't do this. So it's, but I have no interest in suing someone. It just, the level of unsafety I feel of somebody lying about me is just very disconcerting. And it's, I want to be loving, and I mean, for the most part, I can. I mean, this talk has been perfectly timed, so thank you very much. But I haven't had this situation before, and it's, I'm struggling with how best to handle it.
Yeah. I don't, so what to do in a situation where we've been unfairly accused in some way, right? Or maybe versions of that where 10 things happen in the situation and somebody's hyper-focused on one that didn't go quite so well and they're leaving out the rest. Yeah. So first off, I want to say that I think that it's natural for unpleasant to arise when we're attacked in that way. And it's funny. I started, I had this time, I don't know when, a few year or two ago, whatever, where I had this sort of insight that I was ashamed of feeling ashamed. What I mean by that is that I was critical of myself for still being bothered by people who were mean to me or unfairly critical or critical of me. And I realized, wait a second, we're incredibly social animals. There's a lot of research about the basis for developing altruism is concern for reputation. So if we're not concerned for our reputation, there's no way in which humans evolve altruism. Right? Because otherwise you have the free rider problem, where people are exploiting altruism. And what prevents the free rider problem is that your reputation is known inside a small hunter-gatherer band or in society more broadly today. So paradoxically, it's our vulnerability to caring about our own reputations that is a fundamental basis for loving kindness and altruism and generosity. So when I kind of put those together for myself, I realized it's normal and okay this side of enlightenment to still be kind of rattled when that stuff comes at you. Mm-hmm. And that was helpful for me. To just kind of, and so in effect, I mean, calm is not having reactions. Equanimity is not reacting to our reactions. The reaction arises. You know, I'm rattled, I'm upset, cortisol is streaming through me. How dare you? It feels so unjust. You know, why aren't other people stepping in? Right? And equanimity, just like you're saying, is to be a big space of water or a big space of awareness through which those very natural little monkey, what, reactions are flowing through, our little social animal, right? So that would be part one for me about that. And then part two, you know, you probably, maybe this is a good way to finish. Do you know the Buddha gorilla story, speaking of monkeys? I tell this story in Buddha's Brain, so you might have heard it before. It's kind of relevant here. Maybe this is how I'll end tonight. It's actually a perfect story. So the story is, these are from the so-called Jataka tales, which were created during several centuries after the Buddha died. And the kind of backstory in them, or the frame, is that this was before the Buddha was a Buddha, but was going through multiple lives. You don't have to buy into that. Just take it metaphorically. Along his way to becoming, enlightened. And it was at a time or in a context in which animals could think rationally and they could speak. All right. So the story is, a hunter wandered into the forest, got lost, and fell down into a hole. And I'll kind of tell this story fairly briskly. And he couldn't climb out of the hole. He was thirsty, he was in pain, he was hungry, called and called and called. Finally, the Buddha, who was a gorilla in this life, in this incarnation, heard the hunter's cries and came to help the hunter. So the Buddha, the gorilla, looks over the edge of the pit down there and says, and the man says, "Get me out of here, gorilla." And the gorilla says, okay, man. Gorilla climbs down and then says to the man, you know, this is really tricky here. I'm going to roll several heavy boulders down into this pit. Don't worry, I won't let them drop on you. And then I'm going to haul the boulders out to practice climbing out of the pit carrying a load till I feel safe that I can get you out of here. So the gorilla rolls a boulder down, climbs out, rolls a bigger boulder down, climbs out, rolls a really big boulder down, climbs out. Okay, man, I'm ready to get you out of here. So the gorilla climbs down, grabs the man, scratches, claws, pulls his way up out of the pit, carrying the man with him, you know, hauling on the vines, the rocks, whatever. Ugh! Gets the man out of the pit. Man lies there on the ground. Ugh! With his last bit of strength, the gorilla climbs out of the pit himself. All right. The man says, thanks, gorilla. Now, guide me out of this forest. Get me out of here. I want to go back to my village. The gorilla looks at the man and says, well, I'm exhausted. Let me sleep for a little bit. Then I'll regather my strength, and then I'll get you out of this forest. Right? The man says, okay, whatever. So the gorilla goes to sleep. The man starts thinking, it's just a gorilla. I'm a man. If I pick up one of these big, heavy rocks and smash the head of the gorilla with it, I'll kill the gorilla, then I could eat him. And that'll give me my strength, and I can then get out of the forest. Quick sidebar, someone once emailed me and said, how could you tell a story like that? I'm like, I'm just the messenger. All right, it's a fictional account, so let's just pause right here for a little moment, because I could be able to realize, because you have a huge heart. See, it's because you have a big heart, you're rattled by the story, yeah. Right? Okay, so it's okay, so reestablishing, okay, fine, back in the story. So the man does it. He reaches down, and he picks up a really big boulder. Get ready. And he smashes it down on the head of the Buddha, the gorilla, right? Thinking that he would kill the gorilla. But it doesn't kill the gorilla. It's an intense blow. You can imagine, there you are, you're exhausted, you're napping, and somebody smashes you on the head with a big rock. Okay, what up? So the gorilla sits up suddenly, is completely startled. Now let's just kind of slow-mo it right here. What do you think you would want to do if you were the gorilla? Or what do you think a lot of folks would do if they were the gorilla? What do you think a lot of gorillas would do? Okay? Okay? So there's the gorilla. The gorilla's been wrong, right? It's so unjust. What's the natural inclination? Right? Maybe gussied up with a lot of rationalizations, too, and justifications. Okay? So back in the story now. The gorilla sits up, is totally stunned. What? And then sees the situation, sees the man, you know, kind of stricken. Uh-oh, what have I gotten myself into now, you know? And then with blood streaming down the face of the gorilla looks at the man and starts weeping in compassion for the man. And he looks at the man, the gorilla, Buddha gorilla looks at the man, just crying with compassion for the man. Poor man. Now you'll never be happy. That's how the story ends. Wow. Isn't that like, wow. So what's right there? You know, there's a lot in it. And for one, you know, you could read into it, the gorilla recognized that for himself. You know, again, unpleasant has happened. Blood, head, what up? It's unjust. The unpleasant has happened. But the gorilla is not reacting to that reaction. Staying centered. The shock absorbers are there, right? The big space of water. Second, the gorilla is thinking, in a way, we could read into it, I don't have to be the justice system here. I don't have to go out of my way to punish the man. I don't have to get caught up in prosecuting some case. I don't have to enlist a bunch of buddies, my buddy gorillas, those jerk men, those stupid humans. They live in these stupid huts, stupid humans. You know, I don't have to get into any of that stuff. The man's karmas are his own. He's got to live with himself now. And obviously harming, you know, any being in this way, let alone a being that's on the way to becoming a Buddha, you know, is its own punishment. So thinking about people like that, you know, to realize, you know, usually there's a rough justice. So be it. I'm going to do what I need to from an impersonal perspective to stick up for the rights of the person who wears my name tag. But I don't have to lose my balance on uneven ground to, you know, lean too far forward or too far back. Equanimity is stable here. I'm not leaning too far back in fear and trembling. I'm not leaning too far forward and going to war, right? I'm in this centered place, and I'm not disturbed in my core. A phrase from the Buddha, you know, pleasant arises, but it need not invade the mind and remain. Invade and remain. So, given that I've already gone about 6-7 minutes over, maybe we can simply take a minute in silence here, and I'll hang around afterward. And maybe, if you like, open to and rest in the Buddha gorilla. All beings be truly happy and free. And we'll see you next week and probably take this further. Take care.